Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Hello and welcome to the Gold, Goats, and Guns podcast for February 4th, 2022. My name is Tom Luongo and we have a lot to talk about. It is episode 131, right on the heels of episode 130 and on the episode 129. Oh my God, it's almost like I want to do this podcast and make it successful. Today I have with me back the great pleasure of speaking with Chris Sullivan, who I had on the show over Christmas, I believe, or right around early December.
Right before,
And I'll have a link to Chris's last episode where we talked about FTX and what we thought was going on in the crypto markets back then. Today, I don't even know what Chris and I are going to talk about, because before we even hit the record button, we were talking about Marxism and aliens and all sorts of cool stuff, which was great. So, Chris, how are you today? And give everybody the spiel as to who you are, just to remind the audience of who you are.
Sure. Thanks, Tom. It's an honor and pleasure to be with you today. Chris Sullivan, portfolio manager and co-founder of Hyperion Decimus. We are a self-funded small business that is a digital asset hedge fund manager.
Nice. I very much like that. Now, out of curiosity, and this just popped into my head, so this, I'm not trying to put you on the spot or anything, as a digital asset portfolio manager, because it actually just came up with, I had a patron ask me a question about another Bitcoin IRA, and earlier I'm like, now I need to go do some research. But here's one for you. So, do you manage other people's funds or no or anything along those lines?
Yeah, it's a traditional Delaware Cayman limited partnership structured as your normal Wall Street style hedge fund. I emphasize the self-funding because we only answer to our clients. Mm-hmm. We put our own capital behind the fund. We are actually our largest LP as well in the fund. So, and then we also pay fees like our clients at the same rate. So it's kind of a way to not necessarily give back, that's the wrong word, but do something within our skill set that is not what everybody else does, which is feed off of others. Right.
Right.
And then the way we structure the promote is that every year before there's a charge, the first 10% is the clients. So that was kind of a little bit more like a real estate deal where you get like an 8 pref. In this case, it's a 10 pref, but annual. So we thought that we would input what little, you know, nuances we could to separate ourselves from the various sons of bitches that are running too much money and aren't worthy.
I agree. And just to make sure everybody understands, 8 pref, 10 pref, that means 8% preferred distribution, 10% preferred distribution.
Correct.
And so the big question that the one patron had about the fund he was looking into, or the ETF he was looking into, the IRA he was looking into, which was, you know, custodial account versus non-custodial account, is this a your keys, your coins, or is it a no keys, not your coins arrangement, if you're talking about Bitcoin or, you know, anything like that. So just out of curiosity, I'm actually interested in what's happening in the space at this point, especially
it's very
now.
You know, and I could get into some of the tech side because the UI UX, which user interface, mm-hmm. user execution platform, like those are difficult in crypto. In mm-hmm. one sense, I like it because it commands attention and forethought to planning out how you're going to distribute your assets, but it's also mm-hmm. very complex. And you've been in the space for a long time, Tom. So, you know, it's like, you know, even for me with MetaMask and Trust Wallet and Ledger, it's complex, right?
It is.
And if you mess up, man, you pay dearly. So So with Bitcoin IRAs, Bitcoin accounts or crypto accounts through any intermediary, you're going to have kind of that, not your keys, not your crypto. So right. Unless you are self-custodying, then that is the scenario. It's not a one size fits all. I'm also, humbly as a, quasi prepper and then hedge fund manager, which the main job is to hedge. I personally have quite a bit on my, self-custody platforms, mm-hmm. but I also hold some custody at Gemini and Coinbase to distribute my risk.
Right.
I will preface, I don't leave it in hot wallets, right? If you're going to leave it in an intermediary, you want it in a cold wallet that's not in some omnibus hot wallet mm-hmm. account.
And, I agree. And that's also very good advice for anybody, just depending on how, regardless of what it is that they, want to do. And I people ask me this about gold all the time, and I understand the gold scenario as much as anything else. I say to people, they say, well, should I buy, coins, or should I go with a physical ETF, or should I do this? Or I'm like, well, you should do a little bit of everything, but you start with, physical coins in your home and think of them as your savings account, but it's private and it's outside of the banking system. Then you're going to take on, ever increasing counterparty risk, right? In order to have liquidity and have more optionality. Coins sitting in your house, come with a 10% hit on buying them, 8 to 10% hit on buying them, because you're going to buy 8%. And then you're going to hit, and then you're going to get hit on 8 to 10% downside. So when you buy physical coins, you have to think in terms of, is gold going to go up 20% before you, is that what you're doing before you even break even? And that's not even then. And then you have to start paying capital gains on top of that. After that, yada, yada, yada. You're doing it for peace of mind, and which is the big thing. And then beyond that, now you start thinking about, well, do I want to hold some of it in my retirement portfolio, or do I want to hold it in the hedge fund? And then you just choose the people that you're going to work with.
I can, because no one ever does this, Tom. So if you'll allow me to digress, here are why these different setups exist. Here's how myself and my partners tried our best to protect our family and clients. So let's start with the gold conversation. How do I do it, right? I buy both the larger bricks and then grams. Mm-hmm. Why do I do that? The bricks are to get wealth out of the bank and into a hard asset that's got, as much or more price history than anything ever. Mm-hmm. And will always be money. And people need to understand and answer for themselves what is money. Then to have a broader exposure, like you're saying, I hate the ETFs, and we've discussed how piece of shit they are, but does that mean I don't trade them? No, of course I do.
Of course.
Because if I want 15% of my liquidity in gold, I'm not going to use that 15% just for bars, right?
Right.
Because that's not responsible, and that element to it. So I do trade that, and I like investment positions in the miners. Now they've got almost a one-to-one correlation, and they actually have a higher beta than zinc. So if you're buying dips in that, that's probably going to be a more successful performing trade. And then you're going to get a little dividend here and there from a few of them.
Yeah. So no, absolutely. And depending so go ahead.
So that's like a three-pronged approach to being diversified in gold. You've got mm-hmm. the producers, you've got the paper gold, and you've got the hard asset. And you've got to start with the hard asset first, obviously. But
And then for people who want a form of tax, and then obviously you can trade and or hold all these things in a tax deferred account. You also then, I always talk to people and say, okay, well, if you have that already happening for you, then looking at the physical ETFs, not GLD, which is a paper thing, but I'm talking more like, Central Fund of Canada or FIS and all that, so PHYS and CEF, which are different things, right? So like CEF is a closed end fund that holds physical gold and silver. Is it in a vault that you don't control? Yes, it is. Is it in a jurisdiction that's politically a little hinky at this point in Canada? Absolutely it is. These are all things you have to go through, but at the very least, you're not looking there to get any kind of beta. For those of you who aren't initiated, beta means that you're going to beat the S&P 500, or that it's got sense. That's a beta, the sensitivity to the S&P 500. So higher than a beta with a higher, that's higher than one, means that, it trades with more volatility than the S&P 500, and a beta lower than one trades with lower volatility. Right.
Yep.
then there are other gold strategies out there. Some of the miners actually do pay a halfway decent dividend now, mm-hmm. which is nice. I mean, I've been in gold for over 20 years, and you know, 1% used to be oh my God, they pay 1%.
Right. But
because the financing side of the gold industry, this is a separate thing, because the financing side of the gold industry is now much more self-financed than bank finance as it was 20 years ago, thanks to people like Jim Sinclair telling everybody, oh, by the way, the banks were screwing everybody on all sides of the trade with non-recourse loans and bubble and all that stuff, that we have a situation today where, because they self-finance so much better than the miners do today than they did previously, they're no longer at the whim of vulture capitalists. They're no longer at the whim of vulture banks, and therefore they can actually afford to pay, you know, a dividend structure. So even mid-sized producers, you know, 1.5-2 million ounces a year, those are mid-sized producers, and they're 500,000 to 1 million is a mid-sized producer, and they're paying small dividends, 1.5-2% or whatever it is, even in a market like this, which isn't necessarily even a bull market, right? And then you get into something like the closed-end fund strategy of something like, which then plays options. You have something like GGN, the GAMCO Gold and Natural Resources Trust, which then can actually pay you some real yield, you know, but you're then taking on the risk of the closed-end fund and its volatility due to, you know, the current environment. So these are all things to think about. And then all of this stuff is going to wind up being part of the Bitcoin space going forward. We're just building that.
All 5 years from now, we're going to have a dialogue where the entirety of the commodity space is tokenized. But I'll go to that thought in a minute, but let me finish the
investment. This is great.
So then, like, that's a great way for gold. And then why do rich people invest in hedge funds, Tom? Oh, because no matter what, they win, right? So here's our hedge fund. What if we win, right? Especially a fund that like ours that's multi-strat, has algos, we're paying short-term capital gains, right? You can't get away from that. If you win, you're paying short-term capital gains tax, right? But if you lose, you take it as K-1 loss against your income. So as long as you have income, all it does is wash what you otherwise would have owed the government, and you size it accordingly so that if it goes to zero, that's still a fine event for you. That is literally the main business reason of why hedge funds exist. Mm-hmm. So you don't need capital gains to write off against. You can take it as an income write-off. So, and then what we do that I think is pretty nuanced, because I'm not aware of any other fund in the space that does that. Not only do we accept digital assets as contributions for allocations, but we've set up, and almost all of our LPs have these ledgers. So where, God forbid, you know, the world's getting into an area where we need to, you know, withdraw to self-custody at the fund level and then send to our clients, we have that infrastructure in place. And Ledger actually has a branded hard drive that they gave us to give out to clients. So it's a really kind of nuanced thing where you can have the upside of long-term performance of our strategies and the distributed diversified asset mix. And God forbid, you know, the whole reason we're
you have to liquidate the fund.
Guess what? You'll have it in 10 minutes.
Right.
You know,
as opposed to 10 years, if the fund gets into trouble with the regulators or with this one or with that one
there's not going to be a withdrawal problem on our end like some of the other hedge funds that have gated people. That's just inhumane. And the whole reason you're in a hedge fund is to hedge. Mm-hmm. And you know, so we really take that seriously, and we're quite stoked that we feel like we've accomplished that mandate.
Cool. No, that's very good. You and I have been chatting for a while now, and I never really did. I've never even quizzed you privately about any of this stuff because we're all busy and yada, yada, yada. I'm not, you know, making excuses or anything. So it was as much as any, I've been wanting to have this conversation with you for a while. So today is as good as any, and I think this is the right platform for it ultimately, because it's important that, because I know that, you know, just within the Gold, Goats, and Guns community, within the Patreon community, there's a lot of people who don't understand any of this stuff. They don't understand any of these nuances. They're looking for help. I get questions from people all the time about these kinds of strategies, or, you know, what should I do, and yada, yada, yada. And all I can really say is, I'm just some guy on the internet. I don't have a Series 6, don't have a Series 7, not allowed to advise you personally. I do have some people who I trust that you can go talk to them who are professionals, yada, yada, yada. So that way, now that we've done this, I know I have a better understanding of what it is you guys do. And now, like everything else, people listen to your voice. If that's what they want to do, if that's one of the strategies they want to employ. And more importantly, it's not just for you personally, Chris, in this context, but it's mm-hmm. it's to teach people how to fish and how to look at other hedge funds if they want to look in the oil space or the this space or the real estate space or whatever. You now have a framework, an intellectual framework,
right,
with which to then, you know, you can always come back to this conversation and refer to it and go, even if some of the stuff goes over your head today, you know, with repetition comes enlightenment.
And people, you're pointing out a really big hole in people's portfolios. People are so underexposed to commodities. It's mm-hmm. almost like Wall Street engineered it that way, Tom.
Oh, I'm sure.
No, I know. I'm kidding.
say.
You know, and they give us these, you know, piece of shit being a nice word, these capital eroding vehicles, right, for wheat and corn and oil and yada, 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 where we're paying to roll futures and we're paying fees and we're paying trading costs and we're paying create redeem. It's just not a clean, easy way to get access, right? And then the better commodity hedge funds, you'll never hear of any of them because they're not people that are going to go on CNBC and Bloomberg. They're humble people, more humble even than we are, where they stay in the dark. It's huge minimums to get in, right? And you know, they are pretty consistent in the teens with their performance every year. And then that's, to me as an investor, why do we all have to invest and realistically invest aggressively, Tom? That's because we can't sit in effing fiat.
Yes.
Right. How is wealth built? It's in assets.
Right. And you can't build money, you can't build assets. You can't build wealth in a zero interest rate environment. No, this is now we can shift into, in effect, kind of act two or beat two of the podcast, because mm-hmm. now we're going to start talking about Fed policy, right? And because this is the first thing that pops into my head, like for 15 years, we've been sitting here at the zero bound, or in the case of Europe at the negative bound, right? Which is just completely off the charts. It's just communism, folks.
It truly is communism.
Yeah. I mean, it truly is. It's just wealth destructive. It's just wealth confiscatory, you know, it's just in your face, wealth confiscatory. So now, this is why, you know, at the end of this system, after 15 years of them destroying risk assessment and all the things that Dexter and I talked about in last month's newsletter, and we're at the end of that. And it's very clear that I think Jerome Powell understands that this has to end, because even if Jerome Powell was really a snidely whiplash mustache twirling villain, he understands that, well, you know, at some point if you're going to fleece the Muppets, you got to give them something. You got to let them rebuild wealth so you can fleece them again later. Like, you know, it's like, it's no different than the LBMA guys, right? Or the COMEX guys, the CRIMEX guys, you know, allowing gold to run a little bit so we can make some money so that they can short against us at the top and then take it all away from us. This is the way this thing, even if you believe it's that horrific. So in terms of what Powell is doing now and raising interest rates aggressively, he's doing so because the dollar has lost all argument as to why anybody should keep them in any way at the zero bound. You've got to start giving people yield again.
In this one specific instance, Tom, which is so interesting from a macro perspective and historical perspective, it's actually not the central bank's fault this time, mm-hmm. per se, or only the central bank's fault this time. Right. And I will cut the caveat. It is as horrific as you just described. It's probably way worse because what we're aware of, they know, we know they know, and it's probably much darker. But assume that's the case, where, yes, the central bank, having a central bank is part of the definition of communism. But while Powell may be our macroprudential representative of our enemy, in this specific instance here, he is not wanting the dollar to go quietly. At the very least. And then you've got suicidal globalists running Europe and Australia literally into the goddamn ground,
mm-hmm.
for my language. And then
not on this show.
I don't know what to call Washington, because in In England, a lot of the people are quite educated, quite smart. They're just corrupt little peons who are cowards, right?
Right.
Here in America, we have people who can't read or count in Washington. Mm-hmm. And that's 98.9% of Congress. And I would argue that Powell is fighting them perhaps first before dealing with the BRICS.
Right.
And
I don't even think he's trying to fight the BRICS. I think what he's trying to do is realize, I think he obviously realizes that he can't fight the BRICS because the BRICS can just opt out. Eventually, the BRICS just opt out, and they're doing so assiduously. They're doing it piece by piece, block by block, moment by moment. And the way you fight the BRICS ultimately, if you have to make the dollar
attractive.
And the only way you make the dollar attractive
is pulverize the politician's ability to further debase the already existing debasement.
Exactly.
This has been
the underpinning of my argument for 18 or 20 months now. So,
you know, I wish he did 50 this week, Tom, because I thought that, you know, because it was 25, even though he actually had a pretty good presser, and I don't have a personal problem with Powell because I feel like he's quite a bit better than what the Fed has had before in terms of, you know, maybe being perhaps a gentleman. He actually is a, you know, more of a free marketer than Greenspan or Bernanke. And certainly, you know, Yellen was a full on red commie.
Right.
So I just think that, you know, I would have liked to see him be a little forceful here because there's no getting out of the weeds of commodity inflation by raising rates.
No,
there's only stopping or slowing credit creation. He sees that financial conditions over the last 7-8 weeks have actually gotten a lot easier. One of our macro models that tracks M2 globally and then a second derivative rate of change of that flipped positive, like full bull cycle style positive.
Right, right.
And so he sees that, dude, you 25 ain't going to do it, man.
Well, I just want to stop you there for just a second because Alex Graner and I talked about this in the last episode of the podcast that we did on Thursday. And I spent a lot of time thinking about this over the last couple of weeks when it was very clear that he was going to go 25. And I kept asking myself, okay, why? What would be if the thesis that Powell was fighting the globalists, you know, if for nothing else than to save Wall Street and the dollar and just out of pure, you know, enlightened self-interest, right? Yeah. Not in any patriotic sense, just pure enlightened self-interest. Why would he only go 25 here? Well, think about the way the markets reacted after Wednesday, the markets were all like, oh, look, Powell's the dove. He's pivoted. Blah. We had a big, massive gold ran, silver ran. Rates got, you know, the long end of the yield curve went, got crushed, right? So the euro pushed up to $1.10. And then Lagarde opened her mouth on Thursday morning. And then the euro started to fall over. And the credit spreads between Europe and the U.S. had really tightened, like by 15 basis points in 24-hour period. And then, which you know I follow very, very closely as my kind of my bellwethers for what's going on here. And then there was the jobs number on Friday.
That was all.
Now, what the funny part about the jobs number on Friday is you have to think that the Fed knew somewhat what the numbers were going to be. Right? So think of it this way. He goes 25 on Wednesday, gives the market exactly what they want. And then by Friday, knowing full well that the labor data is going to be a blowout to the upside. And yeah, maybe there's, and you know, to Daniel DiMartino Booth's argument, yeah, there's some lag in that data. But it doesn't matter. Remember, he's not raising rates to fight inflation.
Right.
He's raising rates to destroy credit creation and destroy leverage. So all he needed was for the market to wake up on its own, as opposed to bullying the market into going 50, because the market didn't want him to go 50. No, now the market goes, oh my God, Powell was right. And we were wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's a more powerful way to move the market that is in that has been steadfastly in denial about what Fed policy is going to be for the last 6 months. And to me, I think that's ultimately how he did this. Also, by the way, I don't know if you noticed, but Lael Brainard wants out of the Fed. she wants a job. She wants a cushy dead end job with the Biden administration. That further tells me that Powell and the New York boys are like, oh no, we're getting rid of the commies. So
we're pushing. Yeah.
We're going to continue to push. Yeah, yeah. There was something else this morning that I saw that was a clear example of that. Oh, it was Matt Gaetz went on. Was it Tucker Carlson and said, mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, the number of congressmen that are against further funding of the war in Ukraine has risen from 3 to 70 in the last 3 weeks.
Well, thanks, Matt. That's $100+ billion too late, you jerk off.
Yeah. No, but you know, it's not his fault.
I know. I'm just
being... You have to realize is that that's another way of saying, oh, by the way, because Wall Street and Powell are clearly trying to stop. You know, a secondary effect of tight monetary policy is that the Congress can't afford to prosecute.
I mean, my view is twofold. That's the primary reason for doing it. Mm-hmm. And the secondary is self-preservation, because if you can't accomplish the first, the second's not accomplishable either. Mm-hmm. I'm mad at Congress, not necessarily Matt Gaetz. I do like, you know, fellow Florida native. I'm proud of what they did causing all that chaos. Now, I think it should have gone to Rick Scott. I am biased in Florida, but Rick Scott, despite, you know, he has some negative side and is not that personable, he's a freaking genius and he knows how to run the show, and he is a better person for the role than Cocaine Mitch, although Cocaine Mitch has a wonderfully cool nickname.
He does. But look, Senate majority, look, until they're ready, I read all of these things as there's a lot of negotiations going on. One of the guys in the community we've been talking about the situation with all of the major New York banks showing up, the CEOs of all the major New York banks showing up at Davos this year, whereas Klaus Schwab was clearly being pushed to the side. Soros didn't even go. And now he's only interested in going to the Munich Security Conference in order to declare World War III. Mm-hmm. And he may not be able to do so. I look at Jamie Dimon's performance at Davos. I said this to Alex the other day. I think about this. All I can see is Jamie Dimon in the parka on CNBC with the ski slopes in the background and all the rest of it going, oil's going to be with us for the next 50 years. Get over it. And the Federal Reserve is going to have to go significantly higher than 5%. Yeah. He may pause here, but to slow down, but he's going to have to go much higher than that. That is the beginning of, I think, the negotiation between the European globalists and the New York boys. And I think they've decided to take a pause and see if they can come up with an elegant way to back out of this insane Great Reset stuff. To me, this feels like the Great Reset is already over. And now we're dealing with the fallout and the chaos.
You may be correct, Tom, but that would be predicated on like what we see near term. The real like canary in the coal mines is that whole digital ID system.
I agree.
And if Jamie et al, you know, and calling on Kashkari, all of them as Americans need to fight this, because what we are as humans will be upended. Yes. Like, you know, if you listen to these psychopaths, they call it transhumanism, and no one's calling it what it really is. I mean, it's a terrifyingly loaded term that means I'm going to take from you what makes you human.
Yes.
And it's not getting enough friction, in my opinion. Mm. But I think because you've got Wall Street that just, they're heroin addicts, right? Give me stimulus. Just feed me money, money, money. And they're like, wait a minute. Even if you print money, that's not going to matter if we roll out retail CBDCs and we can't make markets. We can't issue securities. We can't do deals. What the hell are we going to do all day? We're not going to be slaves. What do you mean?
Exactly.
You know, I can tell they've all woken up. Dude, yeah. Morgan Stanley, the CEO of Morgan Stanley is fully against it, Gorman. I mean, and mm-hmm. it wouldn't surprise me if, because we know what JP Morgan does in the background with Bitcoin. One of these days, you're going to see Jamie Dimon get up there and go, well, we might have accumulated some Bitcoin while it was low.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, Dimon's whole anti-Bitcoin thing is such a LARP at this
point. He doesn't even say it with any conviction.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't. He just, and he comes up with, and if you listen to him talk, he's like, it's the most like brain dead, anti-Bitcoin arguments. It's just really, and I was like, yeah, that'd be nice. If you can't eat electricity though, what happens if the grid goes down? Like, what happens if the grid goes down? Dude, you don't have a business. Like, I have more of a business than you do because I own goats. Like, let's not, come on, man.
Well, you know, we can trade Bitcoin on RF, Tom.
Yeah, exactly.
So we don't, but literally if like that's the only argument against it, then great. Because if the grid goes down, probably 90% of the population.
Actually, what he said in that CNBC interview when he was asked about this, he's like, you know, it was about, it was actually calling into question SHA 256.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, you do realize, dude, that like your entire encrypted database system that you use at JP Morgan for your trad banking stuff is all on SHA 256. So mm-hmm. if someone can hack SHA 256, which is for those who were uninitiated, that's the encryption protocol for Bitcoin. If SHA 256 is someone's got a backdoor to it, then the entire current global financial system in every way, manner, shape, or form, the modern internet itself goes away.
Yeah. Gone. Now, the good news is people have tried to hack that through Bitcoin's blockchain for 12 years straight, and no one's been able to. So, the history would show that it's pretty indestructible. But there's no way we can piecemeal getting out of something like that, right?
Right.
And funnily enough, and oddly enough, for these World Economic Forum ESG types, the permeation of Bitcoin into New York power grid, Texas power grid, you're seeing it real time,
yes.
stabilizes, warms houses
yes.
and businesses. And so it's got that nature and nurture element to it where it's so holistically beneficial to all of us as human beings that it doesn't even make its own argument because it just right. is.
It is. It's funny. Like, I have a friend of mine who has described Bitcoin as an organism that feeds on energy subsidies mm-hmm. and finds mm-hmm. them and then destroys them, because anybody who subsidizes energy below market cost is going to attract Bitcoin miners who then are going to, you know, suck that up and then force that subsidy out of the marketplace
yep.
ultimately. And yes, exactly what you're saying, like the co-location thing that's been happening with Bitcoin mining. Remember that to everybody's point, just to remind everybody of this point, which is that 30% of the electricity that we generate on the planet every year goes to ground. We don't even use it. It's just used wastefully in order to pressurize an inefficient power grid. So if Bitcoin can suck off 0.5% of that at most, because that's all it uses, as Michael mm-hmm. Saylor made this point one day, they can only use it 0.25% of the energy that we send to ground. I mean, at the very least, it's making the grid that much more efficient. And as you then point out, it also gives the power companies a way to stabilize their grid during offload times and all the rest of it. It's an organically self-correcting system, and actually makes the existing inefficient, monolithically mostly government controlled power grid.
Mm-hmm.
And where it's not directly government controlled, it might as well be, because it's these fascist public private partnerships and all this other stuff, and circumscribed by unbelievable amounts of government regulation, that it might as well be a government utility. Right. That, you know, even where it's quote unquote been privatized, and that's privatization is not free market. That's another definitional thing we have to get past here. You know, when you think about all of that stuff, like Bitcoin is nothing but a benefit to breaking all of those old systems down. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Wall Street has been putting hundreds of millions of dollars into building out Bitcoin mining rigs, or just proof of work mining rigs, doesn't necessarily just mean Bitcoin. You can, you know, mining anything that's proof of work.
Right.
That's just a benefit to society in every way. Just is.
And them and the Silicon Valley boys
yep.
doing it now, Google with Solana and Amazon with Avalanche. And then if I'm regular Joe, I'm seeing Wall Street do that with Bitcoin, and they're creating just all kinds of different products and services around that too, by mm-hmm. the way. And then they know what's up, and part of this downturn is certainly attributed to them, because the news feeds are so negative where people can't even separate FTX from digital assets, which are totally separate, let alone what's the difference between proof of work, proof of stake. But then you also see in the news Boney holding 200 million of Bitcoin. You see Amazon doing a deal with Avalanche and running their nodes, Google running Solana nodes. You think it's going to go to zero? You think it's all about money laundering? Like, what the hell's your problem? Get in and do something responsible, or they're going to eat your lunch again. By being early, by getting in when there's terror and fear. And I just think there are obvious things that people should be looking out for as invest, even if you're not going to put money into it,
right?
Just be, go educate yourself.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a very powerful thing. And, you know, we have a perceptional problem, of course, because we have a system, a media and a power structure that is resistant to anything changing unless it's to their benefit. So we have a perceptional problem of what the benefits are to us of these things, and what's, you know, where we're going to go, where it can actually take us. And, you know, the reality to me is, you know, it doesn't even matter what wins, because the big problem is this frame of reference. I've been just thinking about this the other day. I've been thinking about this a lot. You know, when I make arguments with Bitcoin maxis and I say to them, well, it's nice that you believe that Bitcoin is going to take over the world and make the world a better place. I remember being a gold bug who thought that. And the reality is until Bitcoin operates in an environment that's not dominated by central banks destroying their own product, has never operated in that environment. And now it's beginning to have to operate in an environment where the most powerful central bank is now defending its asset, the asset that it produces, which is the US dollar. This is a new paradigm. So you actually want Bitcoin in this environment. You want its volatility to drop and become more regular. In order for it to become an asset that people can start to get a handle on what its actual valuation is. You want it to survive the kinds of attacks that are coming against it. You want to see if it can operate in that environment where the empire strikes back, for lack of a better term, or even better, the empire becomes its ally. I've been saying for a long time that once we get past this current situation, when the Fed really needs to shore up its balance sheet, it's going to put Bitcoin on its balance sheet.
Oh God, yeah.
I mean, it'd take 10 years for us to get there.
I would argue they probably
already do.
Yeah.
I got a guy who's we have a patron in the community who is in finance and whatnot. And he's like having done some correlation studies, he's firmly convinced. And again, I'm putting this out there. This is his argument that much of the SOFR trade, is actually being backed right now by the Bitcoin trade.
I mean, that would be a perfect collateral to back that.
Exactly. That was his argument. And then he started doing some correlation analysis, some cross asset correlation analysis to prove this to me, and I'm like, that all sounds really good, I'll be honest with you, I'm a smart guy, and that's above my pay grade, but I'm willing to entertain the argument, and then I'm willing to put it out there in the space and let people discuss it. I don't know if it's true or not. I'm not making any claims here. I'm just throwing it out there.
We have not seen, because we're also tech freaks. Mm-hmm. We get tick data on chain. Right. I've not seen so 2 weeks ago we saw $1 billion dollar denominated purchase of Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. We've not seen any that would like single them out per se, because the central banks are not the best traders. They do things very sloppy, whether it's shorting the VIX or shorting gold. You can just see it, paint the tape immediately.
And right.
It's also true in crypto, where you've got way less supply now than you have ever in its entire history. So unless they're smartly, which maybe they could do, VWAPing over days or weeks, a large position, you know, there's not been those single order types where we'd identify some large player. But anywho, that's what I would do if I were them, because they know that 53% of the available Bitcoin that was on exchange pre-FTX is now off exchange. There's only 2% left on the liquidity of supply through mining. I mean, this is in the situation where the enemy Miami, even if they hate it because it's decentralized and outside their control, they still have to participate in it. And anybody who debates me on that, I go, well, then, okay, why the fuck are they buying gold more so than ever before? When they just print money, why do they have to buy gold? They must be concerned with their balance sheet at some point.
They absolutely are. And just to remind this, Chris, I get everything you're saying, all the inside baseball, all the jargon, but I just want to make sure that everybody understands. VWAP means volume weighted average price.
Yep.
So it's a trading term. You see, you used another term just at one point. I can't quite remember, so it doesn't matter. But just so when Chris is doing this,
kick data.
Just understand this is the way guys like him talk about this stuff. I'm just trying to make sure that to the layman in the audience that they get some of this. So when you talk about the Fed like VWAPing into a large position, what you're meaning is that they're buying in such a way as to buy around the volume weighted average price over a particular time period that's important to them in order to get, you know, and maybe that price is 20 grand. And so when it's above 20 grand, they don't buy. When it's at 19 grand, they do buy. And then they may even do some hedging and some straddle strategies in order to get
there. And it's to systematically deploy in a way that minimizes market impact.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's another point to make that why I note in, you know, very kind of gross terms, like I tell people all the time, I say, you know, watch the US yield curve, the important, like the 2 and the 10 and the 30 year notes, maybe even the 5, watch for what happens when we move up or down really quickly towards a quarter point. Because to your point about the central banks not being particularly good traders, foreign central banks will set up on, you know, the quarter point, because it's just a number that to them is easy. It may have nothing to do with chart technical resistance or support, but hey, 3.5% sounds like a buy area for the 10-year note. 3.7, but they'll sell it at 3.75, they'll be buyers at 4.5% and sellers at 3.5% or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to see that and know that that's what they're doing. Because when you see that kind of weird pricing action, clearly there's resistance on the chart of 4.35%. Why did it stop at 4.25%? Oh, it's because the central banks moved in.
Mm-hmm.
That's because, well,
remember, what was it, 94?
Mm-hmm.
Where it was still eighths at that point.
Mm-hmm.
94, 97. I can't remember the day it flipped over. So they've got that auto harmonics to that. And then to your point, like, humans love those round numbers, even though none of the Fibonacci sequences have round numbers in them.
Right. Even though none of them matter, right? But Jim Sinclair used to say, you know, every time gold reaches into the next $100, we're gonna have to do round number bingo. And we're at 900 bucks. Guess what? It's going to get sold.
Right.
You know, there's going to be an opportunity for you to buy at 860 and then, you know, and before it goes to 1,000, you know what I mean? Cause it's just people at 900 bucks I'm selling, you know, and they're not thinking, it's not about, because most people aren't traders and they're not looking at it and they don't even want to know they may hold the asset, but they have no idea what to do with the asset. So it's the same thing with like Apple at 150 bucks or $200. At some point, someone's going to say, yep, that's my target. You know,
it's just natural. You know, the circular loop of theory and practice will continue forever and ever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be mathematically perfect.
No. And it's one of the things about technical analysis that I also remind people about all the time. I know you know this, which is that it is truly a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yep.
Because humans are like electrons. When they are observed, their behavior changes. Right. In a quantum mechanical sense, when you fix an electron in space, you don't know its momentum. And if you can fix its velocity, you don't know where the hell it is. Right. That's the Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. But you can pull that back and talk about how the act of observing a system alters the system. Well, guess what? Humans are just like electrons. When you tell me that you're surveilling my behavior, I start doing random shit. And I do random shit because I don't want you to know what it is that I'm doing. Mm-hmm. Because if I know that you know what I'm about to do next, you're a threat to me. This is just basic human psychology, threat behavior, threat mitigation analysis, threat. That's what we do. We're trying to minimize threat. That's what our left brain does, which is the logic center. And so naturally, we're going to do something weird. And by the way, that's why, you know, almost all econometric models are, well, they're frankly, they're full of shit, but we can get into that conversation. Maybe, yeah. Probably in a different podcast. Cause personally that to me is an hour long fucking rant. I don't even guess there's for that.
No linearity to those models.
Right. But just to remind everybody. So this is why there's a limit to technical analysis and all of the traders speak and all the rest of it. There's no hard and fast rules. And that would even go for, frankly, for, you know, Martin Armstrong and Socrates, right? However much you put stake, stake in that. Like, as you know, I happen to find it interesting. I say this all the time, but it's like, look, you know, it's eventually it will become a self-fulfilling prophecy. If everybody knows that their behavior is being monitored in real time by these people and then they're altered, like, people are then going to, if they know what the date targets are going to be, because I can do the freaking work that boom, they're going to try and do something. They're going to try and alter that thing, you know? So and that's not to take anything away from Martin and the work that he's done and everything else. That's not what I'm trying to do here. What I'm trying to do is just enlighten people that a lot of the quest for predicting the future is a fool's errand. You know, it's like Yoda said, always in motion is the future. And all you can do is probabilities. All you can do is probability clouds.
I was literally going to say it's a game of probability based on the weight of the evidence, right? Mm-hmm. So you can, I mean, part of this is just because humans are so fucking stupid, Tom. It's pathetic. Like, and I say that with the most humility possible.
Agreed.
But I'll give you a good example. Like you said, Apple. Do you know how I would prepare to trade Apple, right? Let's say it's $102. Mm-hmm. I would prepare as much as humanly possible before risking money. Why would I do that? Because that's what you're supposed to do before risking money. So right. How do you do that? You can underwrite the fundamentals, right? But ultimately, price is the only arbiter of truth, because you're looking through at those fundamentals through the prism of the past, not looking into the future, right? And what do I mean by that? Price to earnings, let's say it's 15, right? That is the ratio of the price of the stock to the earnings of the actual company. It is in effect a lagging indicator by at least 90 days because of quarterly reports. How much weighting is that going to have in the future, Tom? Little to none.
Right.
So, okay, I could be the best balance sheet analyst and best predictor of net present value of cash flows, blah, blah, blah. But none of that's going to help me with the future. It only looks in the past. Okay. So then I can be socioeconomic type, even bordering on psychiatrist type, and trying to predict management, sales staff, new product, blah, blah, blah. And that's kind of a more fun exercise. But, you know, with someone like Apple, they have so few products for such a megalith company that I would be like, shit, well, they haven't developed anything new in 15 years. So the probability of them developing something new is very low. So I can't go off that. Then, all right, now we get to quantitative analysis and technical analysis. What's the difference? Quantitative looks at more of the first, second, third derivative of, and technical analysis is kind of like a layman's version of quant, right?
Right.
And quant takes into effect volume, convexity, derivative markets, price arbitrage, everything under the sun, single orders, the intraday wicks on candles, what are those ranges, all that's quant, which is just more nuanced than TA. With that, you at least have to say, what's the bull case? All right, so if it's at 102, it previously was at 200, I have a lot of bandwidth between the next high to be wrong.
Yep.
And then you have to ask yourself, am I going to trade it to 150? Am I going to trade it to 200? Or am I just an investor, I don't care. And I promise I'm going somewhere with this.
Sure. No, absolutely.
So depending on what you decide, let's say we're bullish, we'll trade to a new high at 205. Then we have to look at the base case. Well, the base case is price does nothing.
Right.
Right. What do you do if price does nothing? Well, I'm going to sell. Why? Well, I don't want to be in an investment that's doing nothing. Okay, fine. And then wrap that into some kind of thesis where if you are in, you've got a trading plan, both upward and downward, and an action plan based on both of those moves.
Yes.
And then the last thing to do is anticipate what no one is anticipating, right? Because there's, you know, pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered. There's money for bulls and bears. But unless you recognize that here's what the market would not expect. it would not expect it to be flat. It would not expect it to chop within a 10% range. It would not expect a new high in 30 days and then a new low. Like, right. Get yourself prepared based on all of the aggregate data to have situational awareness of what no one's expecting. I'm not saying it's a high probability that happens, but the more you go through the exercise,
yes,
and exercise that muscle of awareness and processing of all the data, you get to what's right for you.
Yes.
With that process. That, and that's why I took the time to explain that.
No, it's very important that you did that. I really appreciate you doing it, because it's the kind of thing that, you know, I try to do when I go over charts for the patrons there, mm-hmm. with the market reports. You know how I do it. I do it very simply by just looking at candles and looking. It's mostly a trend reversal strategy. Like, mm-hmm. this is where the trend is. This is what the fractals look like through time. Meaning, I look at the weekly, the monthly, and the quarterly, and then try and make those hope create a story out of those. I'm bearish in the short term, weekly. I'm neutral in the medium, but I'm still bullish in the long term. So the weekly chart is bearish. The monthly chart is neutral. The quarterly chart is bullish. Well, what does that tell you? It tells you that we've had a correction. The correction doesn't really mean much to the long-term trend. So investors, if you were in before, there's no reason for you to get out.
And that's a buy dips environment.
And then you're on a buy dip strategy sell into strength strategy. Mm-hmm. So, and then you just wait for the market to, on a quarterly basis or even a monthly basis, to start showing you bearish degradation of your long-term trend. And that's
a really good point that I didn't even get that granular. You got to decide on your periodicity of action. Mm-hmm. Are you going on an hourly bar? Or is it a daily bar? Is it a weekly? Is it a mm-hmm. quarterly? And you must look at the farthest. I like monthly first.
Right.
And before I get down to like 15-minute bar, right?
I don't look at anything less than weekly bars anymore. I mean, honestly, about anything other than trying to figure out what the bond spreads that I've been, you know, and like what SOFR and LIBOR are doing and stuff. That's the only stuff I look at on a daily basis, is like, you know, what's the market think about the big macro picture by looking at some of the most important correlations. Because honestly, at this point, currencies, because I'm obsessed with central bank, trying to figure out what the central banks are doing. I'm looking at, you know, sovereign bond spreads. I'm looking at currencies and those things, but I'm clearly only looking at them from the weekly, monthly, and quarterly perspective.
And those are really the ones that matter for action plan, unless you're hiring a professional, right? I actually said this to a family office I spoke to, because, you know, we do want to grow our practice with good people. So it was a family office in Europe, and I won't like call them out because this was fun but maybe perhaps embarrassing in their part. It was two things that I thought were insightful from my end, which I don't really think I do that much on a daily basis of. He's like, so what's the narrative for all the institutional investors to get in? And my first reply is, I don't know. You're the one that needs the narrative. I'm already in and I'm an institution. So it was hilarious. He's asking me my opinion of what his opinion should be, basically, mm-hmm. in an indirect way. But then the other part of it was, hey, you know, it doesn't hedge perfectly for inflation. So how do we know when to get in now? And I go, wait a minute, what do you mean? It's up, it's at 23,000. It's up 23,000% of the last 12 years. The money supply is up 8-9 times. Didn't it exactly hedge that? And my point with this is, like, you got to look at the bigger picture to even try to comprehend what's going on.
Right. I agree. Agreed completely.
And inflation's the creation of money supply, not commodity inflation. Those are two separate things. You're
yes,
great
they are.
Pointing those out.
Yes.
And assets, whether it be real estate, precious metals, crypto, memorabilia, collectibles, art, assets hedge against inflation.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Without a doubt. Hedging.
It's funny though, like,
hedging against inflation with cross currency pairs and forex trades I don't understand why people will do it. I understand why companies will do it if they've got, you know, I understand why companies would do it. I understand why businesses would do it if they've got FX risk against their revenue stream and their earnings. That makes perfect sense to me. Like that's obvious. But I'm talking about for the individual investor, unless you know, have need of multiple currencies, like, why would you be doing something like
that? No, and it's such a dangerous game of pros,
yes.
like like myself, where it's attractive for pros because there's a shit ton of liquidity, right? But it is, you know, you're swimming with the biggest sharks on the planet, and they ain't nice, and they're always trying to kill you.
Right. And it's like, again, this comes back to something that's come up many, many times. People say to me, like, what strategy would you use for trading gold right now? Because you know gold really well. I said, I wouldn't. If you want to make money trading, go find something stupid and boring that the market's not interested in and trade Microsoft. Or, you know, I used to say Microsoft, that was like 10 years ago. I'm like, buy something stupid that's got high liquidity, that no one's really watching, that moves with the indices and all that stuff. And it's nice and simple. Microsoft is an easy trade. Gold is the most politicized market on the planet. You're trying to trade all of it. You're trying to trade against gold. You're fighting the central banks and Wall Street and these guys and those guys and that guy and all of that. Like, what are you doing? Make life easy for yourself. Go trade Microsoft and then take the profits and buy gold coins with it.
People should take you're exactly right. And people should be cognizant of the fact that why are we fighting them in that? Let me tell you why. And you know this, but let's tell your listeners.
Sure.
They do not want to pay up for something they are accumulating constantly. You, John Q. Public, are the only morons that get scared into selling and let these monsters take advantage of you while they're accumulating an asset that they have no desire to pay up for. It's
not hard.
You want to buy your house up 60%, which is what it's up the last 2 years, or you want to buy it 5 years ago like you did? You know, like,
right.
Of course they don't want gold to be 20,000 because they can't buy as much every day,
right?
If it's 20,000.
Same thing with Bitcoin, same thing with oil, and you know, with
buying, literally, when they created the futures on Bitcoin, the CME got with Virtu, and what were their words, Tom? I know you saw this. We're going to tame Bitcoin with futures. Right. Literally, that's what they said.
Yes.
Oh, and we've got the perfect model for it because we just did it with gold and silver the last 25 years.
Well, that's 20 years. The day that they back in 2017 when they announced it, they went, well, I don't know. That's the end of this bull market.
Yeah. Like almost to the month.
Literally, they announced it, went live, and then 2 weeks later, we were done.
Mm-hmm.
And then into a 4-year collapse and bear market. And then, you know, all you're waiting for at that point is, you know, again, you're waiting for the breakout from consolidation or whatever you wind up with. One of the things that's nice about the, you know, and I was taught how to trade this way or how to analyze markets this way from a guy I used to work with over in Vietnam, a guy by the name of Peter Pham, who I helped ghostwrite his book for that we wrote together 10 years ago. And, you know, and he's just building off of the classic quantitative strategies of guys like Niederhofer. And like, there's a couple other guys, I can't remember their names off the top of my head, but Victor Niederhofer is one of them. If you want to understand where that comes from, that's the guy's book you should read. Right. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple other guys in that space who are the gods of the progenitors of basic quantitative analysis and quantitative trading and risk assessment. But you know, one of the things that Peter taught me back then was that you want to keep it as simple as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You want to allow your brain to learn the patterns without you consciously knowing what the patterns are. You're not writing down, well, this doji star thing does this. No. Just let your brain do the work by just rote repetition and pattern recognition, but by keeping everything as clean as possible. And you will eventually, over time, just get better and better and better at being able to read the story. And once you know how to read a candlestick chart well, you can read the story on the candlestick and go, oh, there it is. There's the story. And then to go back to your point and your very good, I think, a description of the process by which you prepare yourself to make a trade. And then that iterative process becomes quicker and faster and quicker and faster.
Right. And you understand, and the whole point of it's peace of mind. I mean, eventually I got to get to writing a book. It's going to be called Let the Trade Come to You. So I got a nice title, but, like,
excellent title, by the way.
Thank you. Cause it, that's how I invest. Right. And, mm-hmm. You know, even Bitcoin, that it came to me through poker playing in Costa Rica, you know, it's a romantic story on that end. I think on the analysis that I think makes the most sense to people, would you go to your auto mechanic for your brain surgery.
No.
No, right? And so why I'm pointing that out is that I think the asset management sector, whether you Wall Street or it's these CFP types, have really forced people either subconsciously or consciously into wanting to trade themselves, right? Trading is one of the most dangerous, if not the most dangerous environment for people to be in. They've gamified the living bejesus out of it to try and suck you in so that people like me can feed off of you.
Yes.
And you shouldn't be doing it. No. It's cool if you want to. That's fine. Like, I'm not telling people they shouldn't do what they want to do, but it's as stupid as saying, I'm going to have the guy who changes my air filter in my car operate on my brain. That's how insane it is.
Yes.
And, you know, I think diving into the great books, like you mentioned, is a good pastime because people should understand markets. And it is fascinating. Like you were mentioning the weekly periodicity on the weekly bars and then candlesticks. And those are two prisms to look at. The fascinating thing is that the fractals on that interval only have so many subdivisions that they can form, even at the micro price level at 100 milliseconds.
Yes.
It is unbelievable that the same, call it 30, 35 fractal subdivisions,
yes,
and they all have names, yep, are at the micro price degree and the macro price degree. And
it's absolutely one of the
most beautiful things about nature and harmonics in nature and right, physics.
Right.
So I just, like, I've seen a lot of people lose in both kinds of markets, mm-hmm, up markets and down markets. And it's like, man, someone needs to tell them they shouldn't trade. So today it's me.
Look, I was chatting with Alex Craner at the end of the podcast we did the other day. And Alex we both said the same thing. We don't trade anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't trade anymore. I don't even put money at risk, period, just because, like, it's a distraction. I'm better. My comparative advantage is describing the trades that are available to you and describing how to teach you how to see the things available to you, but not so that you can go out there and do so. If you do so and you make money, I applaud anybody who makes a great trade, but it can arm you now when you go to sit down with your guy. And even if, you know, for example, if this podcast were to bring clients to you, for example, or anybody else, that you can sit, they can sit down with you and they can have an intelligent conversation about strategy,
right?
What to do with the money when you hand it to the actual brain surgeon to do brain surgery,
mm-hmm,
right? That's the point, is you're not going to actually act on your own doing this because there's really no comparative advantage for you because you don't live in this space, headspace, 24/7, 365, which is what you have to do to be a successful trader in this respect. It is your job now. You can't just do it casually.
And it's weird a bunch of nerds can have these features, Tom, but you have to have fortitude and strength that can separate you from your emotions.
And it's nearly impossible.
It's very, very difficult. And you have to also know that you can lose everything and make everything all in the same, like, 24-hour period. And that's what makes you competent at it and worthy of capital. And I really shit on a lot of the investment community on the service provider side because they don't delineate themselves well enough. Like you refer to your advisor as your guy, right? But what is that person's role, right? That person's role is access point to the markets. They're not an asset manager. So then blaming them or praising them for the performance of your portfolio is misplaced at best.
Absolutely.
And so I like to look at things, and this is how I invest for my family. Number one, what's the first strategy to do? Number one strategy, accumulation.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, Chris, what do you mean accumulation of assets? Well, what? Well, there's like five things you can buy, basically. So pretty simple. I'm going to accumulate. It can be stocks. That's one of them. Or paper assets, because those are 50% currency derivatives. They are liquid and they're publicly traded. And because of their liquidity, you ought to have some, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you're left with commodities, precious metals, real estate, and now digital assets. That's it.
That's it.
Accumulate all of those in whatever matrix you want, and you'll be fine. And the this and that will do nothing to you. So at least do that first.
Yeah.
And then Wall Street will not feed off you like they have the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And then it's a really nice way of putting it, Chris. It really is, because you know, wealth and the only other asset class I would add to that is people.
Oh, well, that's probably supersedes that because it,
good well, it supersedes friends, all that. Just to remind everybody, the goal of accumulating assets is so that you can live your life, so that you can accumulate the people around you who make your life worth living and give your life meaning and purpose. Because that's ultimately what the whole fucking thing is about.
Yeah.
It's not about anything else. So it's ensuring the peace of mind and the ability for you to be able to predictably in some way plan your future, because that's what we do. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going right back to first principles and, you know, the first words of Mises's Human Action. Why do we act? You know, man acts with a purpose. That's a precept, mm-hmm. right? Man acts with purposefully, yeah. not this, right? Yeah, exactly. So, exactly. He's showing me. It. Remember, this is where Chris and I are doing this on a visual Zoom call, but this is only audio. So he's showing me a copy of The Road to Serfdom, and like, oh, by the way, everybody, like, you don't think you have to read the whole book. Just read chapter 10, Why the Worst Get on Top, because that's kind of what we're. It's kind of what this whole podcast is about. But
it is.
It ultimately is how to keep the worst from getting on top of you, and getting the better of you. So. Yeah, I mean, it's very important to just, you know, you have to think about what your comparative advantages are. Do a SWOT analysis on your own life. And SWOT means strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats, SWOT. You don't have to, it doesn't have to be a big, huge thing. Do those things, minimize the weaknesses, minimize the threats, maximize the S and the O. That's your life. And that's a way of doing
it. And it's this short. It's literally this short. And I can only speak to what I think's reasonable for people to execute on, and then what I do personally, because I've got the old Irish Italian chip on the shoulder. I didn't come from a lot, no silver spoon, nobody handed me anything, and I want my children and their grandchildren, hopefully their grandchildren's grandchildren, to not be in debt coming out of grad school like my wife and I were, right. Not live in a studio apartment with one car with your first job, and to have more choice, because it's not about things, it's about choice.
Yes.
Right. And so I'm going to work till my last breath. My retirement plan is death, because no one in my bloodline or my wife's bloodline has been able to pass on substantial assets to do that. And I have the skill set to do that. So I'm going to maximize it while I'm alive so that there's more choice. Because I think the media, literature, news publications that are paper that people read, like the Wall Street Journal and the Economist, they create these psyops that are nuanced, and people don't they're not as aware they're falling subject to them. Like, oh, you didn't outperform the S&P, or you underperformed this benchmark, right? Well, how does that matter when I'm applying accumulation forever strategy, if that's my one strategy, right? That
right.
They're like conditioning you into this emotional reaction to the net asset value of your portfolio. And in most cases, they're only talking about your liquid portfolio with exposure to traded securities, and creating this condition where your own happiness and psychological awareness is based upon what they're telling you you should interpret it as,
yes.
Which is fuck you, ridiculous.
Absolutely.
And everybody becomes trapped by it. I was victim of it too. When I was young, I was at Morgan Stanley. Oh, look at all these fancy trading desks, and this is awesome. And oh, we got outperforming this, that, and the other. Like, wait a minute. Tom, if I'm hedging, can I even outperform the S&P?
No.
No, because what hedging costs money, doesn't it?
Right.
Oh, funny. Yeah. If I'm accumulating until I die, don't I only want things to go down so I'm accumulating them cheaper?
Right. And so and FYI, Chris, just to even take this one step further,
mm-hmm.
which is, why is inflation preferable to deflation? It shouldn't be. Deflation is actually where it should be, because that increases consumer sovereignty. It increases the value of your saved wealth relative to your ability to then predict and plan for your future action, as opposed to inflation, which is a tax on your savings and on your previous action. So the idea that, well, you know, mild inflation is better than mild deflation is just nonsense. Mild inflation is only quote unquote beneficial insofar as you have a monetary unit that you no longer want to subdivide, because
right.
what you need in a rising division of labor in an expanded division of labor, you need more resolution of monetary units in order to deal with, you know, more nuanced comparisons of objects, wealth. Okay. And so when we, you know, and we get to a point where you can't trade, where you can buy 100 screws for a penny, but you only need 5 screws. Well, what you should be doing is creating a new 10th of a penny or 100th of a penny in order to be able to buy 5 screws, right? What they do is they inflate the money supply, so that's the argument about why the money supply has to constantly rise and why we need to deal with inflation. No. This is why digital assets are so very interesting, because they are, unlike gold, unlike silver, unlike everything else, infinitely fungible. So today we talk about a Bitcoin and its 10 to the minus 8th resolution, as opposed to the dollar, which has 10 to the minus 2 resolution. Well, if we ever get to the point where we're so fucking rich that sats are no longer enough, we can reset the base concept of Bitcoin to being a sat, and then we can trade hundreds of a sat. Wouldn't that be lovely? Because
it's going to happen, I think. Because
mild deflation is what a free market, and not just a free market, but a market where assets are sovereign, where the consumer is sovereign. The producers need to continually produce more value, right, as relative to the base currency of the base currency unit over time, so that we accumulate wealth as opposed to having to expend it. This is the fundamental problem. This is the main reason why I'm in any way, manner, shape, or form actually a Bitcoin bull. It is because of the infinite fungibility of Bitcoin, digital asset in this respect.
And Bitcoin was the leader. If the market chooses another one that's superior, great. I'll pivot to it.
I'm agnostic to that.
Right. And I think that I'll give you an example. I was just at this morning, a Suns soccer game, and I do wear my Bitcoin shirt all the time, especially when it's down, just because it's a conversation starter. And friends come up, "Oh, well, didn't you lose your ass in Bitcoin?" And they don't realize that I've been in it a long time. And I've never sold any personally, Tom. That's why we created the hedge fund to manage around that, obviously. And I said, "No, why? I'm not down. I have 30% more Bitcoin than I had this time last year. How am I down?"
Right. Right.
And it kind of shook him a little bit. He's like, "Oh, I guess you're not." Because it's all relative, right? What's your interpretation of being down? Because you saw, I know you watched the DXY chart. What's that done the last 6-7 weeks? Yep. So is the public aware that they just lost 16% of their wealth that way anyways, from coming from, what was it, 121-ish at the high? Right. Mm-hmm. It's the prism with which you want to interpret things, right?
Right.
And there's recency bias, anchoring, confirmation bias. I lead with the accumulation side. So my gut reaction without thinking was, "No, I'm not down. I have 30% more Bitcoin than I had this time last year." Cause I was buying, when it was sub 20.
I got yelled at on a panel by Mark Skousen during the middle of a Newsmax conference, during the middle of the gold bear market in 2014. And cause I never sold an ounce of gold. I'm like, why would I have sold?
Because then you got to pay tax too.
I have to pay taxes. I have to do this. I have to do that. So he's like, "You're one of those guys who didn't even sell. You don't have a trading strategy." My trading strategy was no. I just sold. I'm going to buy more gold. And when gold goes back up, guess what? I'll have more dollars to sell these. If I need to sell the gold for dollars in order to run my life, fine. But I have more gold now than I had at the top of the market in 2011. Why? Because I did exactly what you did. I just waited for it to start dropping, and then, look, it's $1,100. I think I'll buy a couple ounces of gold.
Because there's no way I was going to pay the Biden regime the amount of long-term capital gains. No way I was going to do that.
Right.
Small world, Tom. Dr. Skousen's son was a peer of mine in high school. Taught
is insane.
Yeah. And I do, he's a good value guy, but
I wasn't trying to throw Mark under the bus. He actually publicly was trying to throw me under the bus at this conference. So I'm just like, "Oh, I'm going to throw it back. I'm just throwing it back." But it's just to make this point. It's not about that. I was here to accumulate gold and silver And we're just talking about it. That's my, that was my.
Plus your break even's 35%. So you got to go anticipate that large of a decline, then nail it. Or you didn't even arbitrage your taxes.
It's insane. Now, I mean, now we're talking about gold that I bought at $400 an ounce. But so what? I mean, I did the math. I did exactly the math you did. And I'm like, I got to think that this is going to drop 35%.
Okay, and then you got to nail it. And then you've just broke even.
Right. So it's got to drop 40% for me to make money.
Yep.
Money. Make money. And I'm using air quotes here. Chris and I are talking. I'm using air quotes here, folks, to make money. Did I make money or did I lose money? I didn't lose any money. No, I lost dollars. But did I lose dollars? Not if I, you know, it's like everything else. It's like your strategy should be, people ask me this all the time, and I'm sure you feel the same, exact same way. What do I do to buy gold and silver? What's the first rule? Buy as much metal as you can per dollar that you spend. What's the second rule of accumulating gold? See rule number one.
Yeah.
It's not tough.
Don't talk about Fight Club.
Oh, no. I mean, so when I go to Atmex, for example, I go and I look at what's on sale. I'm like, oh, look, it's going to be Mexican. It's going to be 1950s Mexican pesos with a big scratch through the middle of them. Great. They're awesome. They're 3% above spot. I'm not buying U.S. Eagles at 12% over spot. I'm buying the most metal I can get for the least amount of money.
Right. Because you need to melt it down if you needed to. And
right. Because it's just gold.
And I like mixing on the silver side. I do have some bullion bars, but I love the different 1 ounce coins from other countries. And
of course,
I trick my kids, and they love doing this too. I've got a 7 and 9 year old. They've got the pretty, like Barbados has a marlin on there. It's really pretty.
Nice.
You know, the Cougaran's real pretty. And then there's a kangaroo on the Aussie one.
I'm a big fan of the Perth Mint stuff. The Perth Mint Chinese. I have a lot of the Chinese New Year. I say that, and that's the third rule, which is that once you've satisfied that level, then you could also think about, well, I'll pay the extra 5% to get the current year of the Chinese panda or whatever coin you want, because you never know. Numismatically, it might go up in value
on the
over and above. You might get some numismatic win, and that would be the stuff you preferentially sell into peaks, because then you might actually make that 35% that you need to make after you pay capital gains. You may even make more money than that, because you can hit it well in that year you bought the thing that they didn't have, that no one else bought, and then they only printed 6,000 of these coins, and now 20 years later everybody wants them. And you know, I've seen some of the buy prices for some of those Perth Mint coins going, I'm not only up, you know, the I bought them for $350 an ounce, but they're Atmex is buying them for $2,800 an ounce or $3,000 and selling them for $4,000. Like, but again, they're not going to get sold because that premium for me, that numismatic, is only going to go up over time.
I got some from the Perth Mint. I think it was 34% above spot, and they're calling because, you know, I'm a very loyal human, and I only will make a relationship if it's going to be a good, productive, long-lasting relationship. Sure. And so I'm giving my business to a few dealers and miners, right, that I constantly buy from. They're like, hey, Sully, you know, we know you have this. We know you have this much because we sold it to you. We're willing to pay you this over spot. And I'm like, oh, well, that means I'm definitely not going to sell it.
Thanks for letting me know how tight the market is. I really appreciate that.
And, you know, it really is important to bring in that, you know, theory of relativity side, because one of the greatest trades of the last decade has been holding gold in yen terms, Tom.
Right.
You know, and like I can't tell if it's humans or just Americans, but I think it's all humans. We've been so propagandized, gaslit, abused mentally, physically, monetarily, that no one's paying attention. I'm lucky because digital assets has this new 24/7 maniacal problem that we rose to, especially as being like 40-year-old men. That's, you know, we're getting less hair and grayer hair, but it's given us a deeper prism to look through, where there's more colors. And we have this U.S.-centric dollar denominated viewpoint, and that's not how life is,
right?
And it's probably one of the reasons our politicians do not reflect the quality of our communities. Because outside of the blue cities, where I would argue we got to give these people the benefit of the doubt, they're all victims, right? The people that are stuck in shithole projects, working service industry jobs or government jobs for no pay and shitty healthcare, and they're victims. And perhaps those of us that, like you, who are patriots, should give them that sympathy, empathy, and go in and try and bring them up. Now, I think this is teetering here, because I know the globalists and the World Economic Forum folks want to see America go into a civil war. But because of our sense of community as human beings, aside from the paid rabble rousers, I don't see that happening.
I don't either. And it's funny. I was just chatting.
Sorry for the segue, but I thought
it's a perfectly good segue, and I think it's be a good way to kind of tie a bow on this, because not only was this, I think, a good podcast from an educational perspective for people about trading strategies and all of this stuff, but and philosophies of markets and whatnot, but also it's leading towards the ultimate thing here, which is that we're just trying to accumulate assets to build communities and to stabilize our communities. So I was chatting with my wife earlier, and she kind of randomly, or she was watching something, and she's like, I freaking hate vegans. And I'm like, yeah, you know, so do I, but really I have to say, we have to stop thinking in those terms. Like, because the truth of the matter is that those people are also victims. They're victims of the PSYOP and the abuse and everything else. And they're manifesting their abuse by over empathizing with cute animals, and that abuse, and then projecting that abuse onto the natural world that we're a part of. And it doesn't matter if we're talking about vegans or we're talking about, you know, I also feel that as a certain level that this trend towards the gender dysphoria that's going on is also a manifestation of this psychological, physical, and monetary abuse. And monetary abuse is just another, and there's just another PSYOP. It's just another form of psychological abuse. And I'm not saying that there are plenty of people in the world, I'm sure, that are honestly gender dysphoric at a physical level or whatever. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about there's a lot of people that have been abused, and their response to this is this trauma is a wide variety of behaviors, one of which happens to be, well, I'm trans. And it's a cry for attention, just like it is no different than it is, just no different than it is for a lot of other people and a lot of other, you know, aberrant behavior. Or I hate to use the word aberrant. I really am not trying to be judgmental here. It's that, you know, like when you put people under stress, you get all sorts of weird behavior. And
it's from the food.
It is what it is.
It's from all angles. And I really hate when people like refer to themselves as victims, or you have like, and Bill Maher calls it out perfectly. You have this race to be who the most victimized, because then you're the highest on the leftist hierarchy. Mm-hmm. But there shouldn't really be the left-right paradigm, because there's law, which is the law of God. Mm-hmm. That's it. There's nothing else.
Right.
There literally is nothing else.
Now, all the other laws are, in my mind, have always been nothing but, you know, these are just control structures trying to usurp our responsibilities to each other and to allow psychopaths to abuse us. That's what they're for.
And your wife is right with what she really means when she says she hates vegans. Is not their election to eat only vegetables, right? Mm-hmm. She's not, because she's not critiquing that. She's critiquing their behavior and their superiority complex, or their supremacy related to, I'm morally higher ground than you. Right. Whoa. Where, wait a minute, red meat, if fed properly, is the most nutritious thing for human beings to eat. That is a scientific fact. Sorry, vegans.
Yeah, I love vegans. It is. I've looked at, you know, it's like we, as great apes, you know, we're the only ones with a short digestive tract and a big brain. And there's a reason for that. It's because we started cooking our food and the evolution took over that we did not. Once you denature those proteins, hi, chemist, once you denature those proteins and you make it all more bioavailable, we don't need the digestive tract necessary. We don't need the digestive tract of a goat to digest our food.
No. Yeah, and we don't have four stomachs like cow.
Goats are a great example because they eat everything, and mm-hmm. they're the ones that we've had the longest relationship with other than dogs. And I got news for you. Ready? Goats are in ketosis. All herbivores are. They can convert all of the starches and the sugars into ketones before they actually metabolize them. It's like they're not in glucosis, they're in ketosis, by the way, which is why they're lean, which is why they don't have diabetes, which is why blah 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 blah. I went through that, I'm like, oh, it's so very obvious to me. So even them, they'll tell you, if we could communicate with them that way, they're like, oh yeah, you don't want to eat like that. But they're herbivores in order to take that. That's a different world, that's a different path to the same, unlocking the same bountiful energy that mm-hmm. comes from the sun and comes from, the background energy of the universe. And that's what we're dealing with. And there's no way around that. And, yes, you are correct that what my wife was reacting to in effect is that whole moral superiority that I look at it as you're just denying yourself your basic humanity, which is that you are a predator. You are who you are. And, you should, you don't have to be cruel and you don't have to be vicious, but you have to survive as well. And you take from the land that which you need and nothing more. And this again gets back into this, what we were talking about earlier in this conversation about the waste associated with the bounty that capitalism in effect creates, we can create 1,000 screws for a penny. Or 100 mm-hmm. screws for a penny, when we have created such, and we have to buy 100 screws and only use 5 of them and throw the other 95 away. Well, if we had a better monetary system, if we had a better way of handling capital and dealing with the wealth we generate by not listening to the psyop that you've described in terms of what Wall Street is actually trying to sell us and what the central banks and the globalists and frankly all the sociopaths are trying to sell us. There wouldn't be that level of waste. We would just, we would more naturally improve the efficiency of how we handle capital as opposed to waste it the way we're doing it now. And that's much of what the environmental movement is complaining about. Well, and they're right.
I love that you brought that up, because as a surfer and Floridian and salt life and whatnot, like I naturally want the most holistically beneficial environment ever. I love all species. I do everything outside with my children that I possibly can, scuba dive, surf, fish, etc. I have hunted. I'm still a hippie. I can't bring myself to, shoot anything anymore, but that is hypocritical. And I still eat a lot of red meat, mostly red meat actually. But the argument that only ESG has it right, which is now shown to be fraud. Like my position as a known conservationist within my groups gives me an ability to kind of navigate both ends. I go, guys, I just ask a bunch of seriously obvious questions that no one's thought about, going, can someone tell me if carbon dioxide is actually a pollutant?
And then
like the doctrinal environmentalists will go, oh shit, it's not. And then you can start, you can't just go, oh, well, ESG is fraud because BlackRock and Vanguard and the World Economic Forum. Well, no shit. It's not necessarily fraud. It's a usurping or usury tax on you idiots who are letting us do it.
Yes. You are the carbon they are trying to reduce.
Exactly. Now.
And, I have slaughtered my own animals.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done so because I felt it was important at some point to go through that process.
Oh yeah, it definitely is.
I mean, you stand there and you're looking at this and then you go and you say a prayer, you say whatever you have to say. I don't, not a particularly religious guy. My thing is, I've got the I'm sorry. And I say it with every amount of empathy, but this is what happens next, because you're only alive, Mr. Duck, Mr. Goat, whoever, because I brought you into this world. Mm-hmm. And I brought you into this world to eat you eventually. And I gave you the best life I could up until your final moment. And then that'll be that. And then
Tom, that is prayer. Like that is 100% prayer. And that's honoring Mother Nature. I mean, look, that's exactly what Native Americans did. Now they would pray to the goddess of the deer before going to shoot the deer and cleaning the deer. But sure. That is making yourself aware of the hierarchy of the food chain and mm-hmm. also not taking everything for granted. You know, like right. I what I just said, like carbon dioxide is a physical fact, a chemical fact, right? But does that mean I think we're not polluting? No, those two aren't mutually.
They are not the same. You know? They are not the same conversation. They are not the same conversation. So, I'm confronted with rabid environmentalists, I just look at them. I go, so why do you hate trees so much?
Right. Oh, because we're burning them in biomass plants. It's sustainable, Tom. Let's just.
But why do you hate Norwegians?
Right.
You're worried about global warming. Why do you hate Norwegians and Canadians? They like to be warm.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't they grow food? This planet's been warmer and it's been colder. And I got news for you. The universe is hostile. And the base case for the universe is it's freaking cold.
Wasn't there a record low? Because as a surfer.
This morning.
Yeah,
it was this morning in New Hampshire, Mount Washington Observatory in New Hampshire. I just said that was part of the conversation I was having with my wife earlier. The observatory there, wind chill factor of a minus 109, which is a record, beating the previous record of minus 103. And it was on zero hedge, and which is colder than the average temperature on Mars. Because there is no wind chill factor on Mars because there's no atmosphere. So the average temperature on Mars is minus 81 degrees Fahrenheit. And so this morning at 6,000 feet in New Hampshire,
was
25 degrees colder than it is on Mars.
That sounds unnatural.
Global warming, my fat hairy ass. But I'll get into that with Dave Collum again when I have him on the podcast.
Well, you know, if you talk to, because as a, you know, I took meteorology, ironically, at the CDC in Atlanta, believe it or not, because I went to Emory University. But I've been monitoring this stuff for a long, long time. There are these flash freezes, ladies and gentlemen, are certainly unnatural. I don't know, Tom, if you talked to Dane Wigginton. He's an OG in the terraforming geoengineering stuff that's been going on. But I saw the little headline on the weather app, right? But I didn't go into detail. But that magnitude of discrepancy is perhaps proof that something funky is going on. And then
it absolutely is. Look, we are, you know, we've been going on for a while now, and I'm going to put a bow on this and keep it back and go there. But just know that global warming is not the catastrophe we should be prepping ourselves for and preparing ourselves for. The wealth you should be accumulating is to prepare for the colder planet, not the warmer planet. The sun is going into a downwave. The reality is that, you know, the solar wind has a huge impact, and perturbations in the solar wind have a huge impact on global weather. And we should be worried about that. And these polar vortices that are coming out are a function of a weakening Earth magnetic field, which, by the way, has nothing to do with CO2. It's everything to do with celestial mechanics. And, you know, it's just what it is. And you can put your head in the sand and you can, you know, get all ideological about it, or you can look at or you can broaden your frame and then go, oh, that's what's going on. It's February 5th or February 3rd, 4th here. It's whatever day it is, Saturday in early February. And I'm on my back porch at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm having to wear a hoodie and it's cold out here, and I need to get off this porch and stop smoking the cigar because I'm getting cold. So as much as I love talking to you, Chris, I think it's about time for me to go. It's colder here in February than it has any right to be in North Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So
this winter's been, I like it because we get such beautiful lighting when it's really cold.
Yes.
It's really neat in Florida.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the air is so clear. Where I live in North Florida, you know, and it's a clear night and there's no moon. You can see the Milky Way very clearly against the background, and they got very little light pollution where I live, and it's great. internet service is kind of crappy, but you know, hey, can't have everything in this life. So Rick, Chris, this has been just an absolute blast and a wonderful talk. And I've really enjoyed every minute of it, but I think it's about time to wrap it up. So is there anything else you want to say on the way out the door? I'll give you the last word and then we'll go.
No, just people be nicer to one another.
That's a brilliant way to end any podcast. So Chris Sullivan, appreciate it. Appreciate your time, your diligence, and all of it. And if anybody's interested in what Chris is offering, I'll have links in the podcast, the show notes of the podcast and all the rest of it. And we'll talk again soon, my friend. You be well.
Cheers, brother. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, that'll about wrap it up for episode 131 of the Gold, Goats, and Guns podcast. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. I want to thank Chris Sullivan for being really generous with his time. I know that we could have taken that conversation for probably another hour and a half, and still not like ended it, because Chris is a great guy and a whole lot of fun to talk to. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be back soon with another episode. You can follow my work over at tomlomago.me. You can follow me on Twitter at tfl1728, and you can sign up with a Patreon at patreon.com/goldgoatsandguns, where I take care of my patrons and try and make sense of a world going crazy. And that should do for this episode. So you guys be well, you take care, we'll talk soon. Keep your stick on the ice.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.